Now, for the last six weeks, we've been exploring through the very ancient story of Abraham and Sarah, what it takes to become the people that God imagined, the person that God imagined, the church that God imagined we could be. And in Genesis 12, at the beginning of Abraham's story, God called them to be a family that would not only be blessed by God, but also would bless all generations, all nations to come. Generations after generations of people being blessed by a God who is faithful to his people. Now, if you've been following this story of Abraham, you'll know that it's far from a straightforward story. There are many ups and downs. There are many twists and turns. There is time when they make progress, and it seems there is time when they regress back to where they started. I'm guessing a few of us in this room know exactly what that feels like in our own lives as well. But through it all, I think that they and we can learn some really important things, and I hope that as you've dug into the story, that God has been telling you, teaching you some new things. I think they've been learning how to activate faith as they encounter God and understand that he is a promise-making and promise-keeping God. I think they are living in the reality of what it takes to build community, as they wrestle with relationship issues and as they try to stay focused on God's desire to keep everyone connected when things go wrong. And I think they are laughing about how to cultivate generosity in the light of God's impossible provision for them that turns into the reality of provision through them to others as well. And is of course, these three themes which are driving us as a church forward in 2026, as we too take up the challenge to become the church that God imagined. Now, our New Testament text for 2026 is found in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 to 16. And as part of that passage, Paul envisions that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. That's some journey to take for all of us to become the people, the church that God has imagined, attaining, growing to that place where we attain the full measure of the fullness of Christ. And so linking the Old Testament story to this particular passage that we have for our year in Ephesians 4, we've picked out these three themes to drive us forward into whatever God has in store for us in the future. And so for our final look in this story of Abraham and Sarah, and there is still more there that you can find, and I urge you to read the whole story. This week, we've got Isaac with them finally as well. But we hit one of the toughest passages I think the Bible has to offer us. God's promise of a son has been fulfilled through Isaac. He's been born to Sarah and Abraham, despite they are very old and well on in years, as generously the Bible tells us about them. And here's Isaac, his name reminding them both, and I think reminding us about how they laughed at God's impossible promise. In Genesis chapter 22, we read this. Sarah became pregnant, bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the very time God had promised him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. When his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. It's a beautiful story. Isaac's name means to laugh, and so embedded in their journey, embedded in this story is laughter because of a God who provides beyond what we could ever imagine. But in so many ways, this story, not just of this passage, but this whole story is our story as well. The highs and lows of faith, the joy and frustrations of building community, and generosity of God and the scarcity of our trust to let go. And it reminds us just how we can know a God who sees what we can become and who will stay faithful to those who will believe in him. Now, I've encouraged you to read along the story with us, and so we've got 6 slides today, so if you want to carry on, then I'd love you to read with me today our passage from Genesis chapter 22. I couldn't shorten it. It's a full story, so I encourage you to read it as well so that we can hear this spoken out in the room. Let's read together. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him 2 of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the 3rd day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the 2 of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the 2 of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided." Well done. Thank you. Excellent. So what are we going to learn today from this story about how we can cultivate generosity in the light of a God who is the provider? Now, I realize that framing this particularly challenging story around generosity, it will leave many important but unanswered questions as well for today. So I'm going to have to put some of the really tough things aside, but please, I urge you to wrestle with them. However, I do just want to just highlight some of the challenges there. Some of us will know, if you've been in the UK for any time, you'll know Richard Dawkins, a British evolutionary biologist and zoologist, who a few years ago was perhaps the most well-known and vocal atheist in the United Kingdom, denouncing religion and decrying anyone who believes in God. Now, he had this to say about this particular story in the book The God Delusion. "By the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example simultaneously of child abuse, bullying in 2 asymmetrical power relationships, and the first recorded use of the Nuremberg defense, 'I was only obeying orders.' Yet the legend is one of the great foundational myths of all 3 monotheistic religions." I don't think he's saying anything complimentary, by the way, about this story in this particular setting. But it has to be said, doesn't it? When you see a story like this, when you read a story like this, we have to ask some of these very tough questions about it. A few decades before Richard Dawkins, in 1843, the Danish theologian and philosopher Søren Kierkegaard wrote a book about this part of Abraham's story. He entitled it Fear and Trembling. It's an appropriate title for a very complex and perplexing story. And he says that this story shows Abraham's unreserved obedience to be the essential leap of faith needed to make a full commitment to his religion. The conviction that an individual can have an exceptional mission in life. So in this book, Fear and Trembling, Soren Kierkegaard does not focus on God's generosity in the warm, comforting sense, that of provision and blessing and kindness. Instead, God's generosity appears hidden inside trial, demand, and impossibility. And he concludes that God's generosity is seen in that God is the giver of impossible promises, the restorer of what is surrendered, the one who transforms faith through testing, and the faithful covenant maker who does not ultimately abandon his word. Kierkegaard says that God's generosity is not comfortable. It is often paradoxical, some would say absurd, irrational, and even unintelligible. But it is nevertheless a glimpse of a God who is generous to all who will trust him. A God who gives, asks everything back, and then gives again in a way that deepens faith. Paul, in writing to the Philippians in chapter 2, says, "Continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose." And sometimes his work in us is going to be tough. It's going to be hard. It's going to be trials. It's sometimes not even going to make sense. And yet God's direction for our lives is one of generosity to call us on to the mission that he sees we can fulfill. Some of the things that have happened in your life may not make any sense still. But we can begin to build a picture of a God who through it all is generous to those who trust him, who empowers his people in the midst of those challenges to be the people he imagines that we could become. God promises a son. He gives a son and then asks Abraham to give him the son back. The son he waited decades for, the promise, the future, the miracle. This perhaps is one of the most emotionally charged stories in the Bible, and yet at its heart, I still believe and trust that we can find lessons that will help us still cultivate the generosity of God as he has given it to us. Not financial generosity, not occasional generosity, but surrendered, everyday, whole life generosity. A generosity that God is asking for all of us to give back to him so that through him we become the people he imagines. So what could that look like for each of our lives? Well, I think generosity begins with trust. He says to Abraham, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, and sacrifice him." Notice the language. Your son, your only son, whom you love. God isn't asking a random offering from Abraham. He's asking for the thing that Abraham clings to the most. Abraham has another son. If you've read the story, you'll know the other son, Ishmael, through Sarah's servant Hagar. And God has a plan for Ishmael as well. You can read that what that plan is in Genesis 21 as well. But this is where generosity begins. It begins with trust. Abraham had to decide, is Isaac my security or is God my security? Remember what Jesus said a little bit later, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Generosity is always about the heart. Now, you may well have read this quote from C.S. Lewis already. I thought it was on a separate slide, but it wasn't. So there we go. He has this to say. "Every faculty you have, your power of thinking or of moving your limbs from moment to moment, is given you by God. If you devoted every moment of your whole life exclusively to his service, you could not give him anything that was not, in a sense, his own already. So that when we talk of a man doing anything for God or giving anything to God, I will tell you what it's really like. Oh, he doesn't tell you what it's really like. Let me tell you what it's really like. It's like a small child going to its father and saying, Daddy, give me sixpence to buy you a birthday present. Of course the father does, and he is pleased with the child's present. It is all very nice and proper. But only an idiot would think that the father is sixpence to the good on the transaction. When a person has made these two discoveries, God can really get to work. It is after this that real life begins. The person is awake now. That what we give back to God, God has already given it to us. Let's not think anything different than that. But when we do give it back, that's when God begins to do his best work in us. And that reframes everything, I think. We're not owners, we're stewards. Abraham's journey up the mountain was a walk of trust, trusting that even if he didn't understand God's request, God's character was still good because God has proved it to him time and time and time again. So what might generosity look like if we begin to trust God? If we trust him with our career decisions, if we trust him with our dating or our relationships, when we trust God with our money and when the budget feels tight, when we trust God with time when we're already feeling exhausted, generosity is cultivated in the good soil of trust. That's when it begins to grow, and that's when we begin to see God do his best work in us. Generosity is practiced in ordinary obedience. Early the next morning, Abraham got up. No delay, no bargaining, he just obeys. Sometimes we imagine that generosity is a dramatic, once-in-a-lifetime act, but it is mostly built on small, daily obedience. Jesus says, whoever can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Generosity isn't the surprising action of a hero, it's the daily formation of a habit with people just like us. Sending an encouraging text, offering to pray with a co-worker, being fully present with your kids when they're in the room with you. Every day, walking through the places of deep hunger in our world and doing something about it. The lonely colleague sat at the next desk from us. The anxious friend who we desperately want to just walk with. The overwhelmed parent at the school gate. God is inviting us to reflect his character and respond to what we see right in front of us and to respond with what he has already given to us, just to open our hands and practice ordinary obedience. Ephesians chapter 4, our passage for this year, reminds us that Christ himself gave gifts, and those gifts are given to build up the body, the church, so that everyone grows, to let go of the gift he's given us, to use it for his honor through ordinary obedience. And perhaps it means waking up each morning and saying, God, where can I meet the need of someone I'm going to see today with what you've already given me to give? It starts with trust, to give him back what it is that he's entrusted into our lives. Generosity requires open hands. Abraham cuts enough wood, and together they set out for the place God has told him about. On the third day, he sees the place in the distance. 3 days of walking and waiting, carrying this burden, not just the wood. He carries fire and the knife in his hands. But isn't it interesting that Isaac spots what's missing on that journey? Where's the lamb for the offering, Isaac says. And Abraham responds with open hands. God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering. And yet Abraham binds Isaac, lays him on the altar, the ultimate open hand moment. But we mustn't feel that this is the unfeeling, dispassionate action of a cruel and heartless and mean God. This is the open-handed response of someone who has learned about God through every circumstance of his life. Abraham has seen God at work. He's seen God provide. And he opens up his hands and allows God to guide these next moments. In the moment of deepest uncertainty, he continues to trust God's promises above his own plans. and God provides a ram. This is the place the Lord will provide. The paradox of generosity when we open our hands and let God do what he's asking, we discover God's provision at its most generous place. In Luke 6:38, Jesus says, "Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." Notice Jesus doesn't say give so that you can control the outcome. He says give so that your generosity can align with the kingdom of God, reflecting the heart of God, being a representative of the image of the generous God. The story of Genesis 22 whispers forward to another father and another son, only this time there is no ram in the thicket. Jesus asks for another way, but in tears and sweating of blood, he accepts the father's decision. Isaac says to his dad, "Where is the lamb?" John the Baptist says, as Jesus passes by, "Look, the Lamb of God." And Jesus steps forward and offers all that he has for us. It's a powerful story that teaches us so much about who God is. I was thinking the other day about my granddad. Do you find granddads annoying? I had a very annoying granddad. He used to play a trick on me. Your granddad may have done this as well. He would offer me a coin if I could guess which clenched fist the coin was hidden in. And he'd hold out his fist like this, and he'd let me choose to see if I could find the coin. And every time I chose the clenched fist and he opened it, there was nothing in it. Whichever one it was, there was never a coin in it. And I couldn't work out to this day why there was no coin and where it went. And after I'd chosen wrong, he gave me another challenge. He said, "If you can open this fist, you can have what's inside it." And I desperately, for several years, tried to open his clenched fist to find the coin that was in it. But I failed every single time. Granddads are annoying, aren't they? But as I've got older, you know, I've realized that a clenched fist is missing out on the potential that an open hand has. A clenched fist may have had that coin all along, and it keeps it very safe. But a clenched fist cannot receive anything else other than what it already has. An open hand might risk losing the coin that is in it, but an open hand is in a position to receive much, much more in return. See, I think some of us maybe are living with clenched fists. Fists that are clenched around controlling our own lives, clenched around our image, maybe clenched around comfort that we don't want to let go of for any reason. Fists ready to fight to keep what we have inside them, rather than open hands that are ready to give what we have already been given by a generous God. But open hands that are not only ready to give what God has given us, but open hands that are ready to receive even more from the God who is generous towards us. The only way we're going to cultivate generosity is when we allow ourselves to be overwhelmed by the generosity God has to give us. So how can I cultivate generosity every single day? Can I encourage you to start the day surrendered? Before you check your phone, before you check your email, maybe before you have a cup of tea brought to you by somebody who cares, just say, "God, everything I have today is yours. Everything I have today is yours." Practice being interruptible. I don't know if you even know that's a word, but it's a great word. Make space to be interrupted. Allow a bit of margin in your schedule just to be interrupted. Because if you read the Gospels, what happens when Jesus was interrupted? I think he did his best miracles when he was interrupted. And he took time to stop with the person who had interrupted him. Give something away daily. Encouragement. Give away some encouragement. Give away some money. Buy a coffee. Give some time away. Give attention away. Give forgiveness away. Make generosity a muscle memory. That's how we get used to doing it. And remember what you're really holding. Your job, your kids, your apartment, your talents, your gifts. Sorry, all these things are gifts. They're not guarantees, don't forget. I'm not a consumer. I'm a contributor. I have a posture of open hands. And generosity might make us vulnerable. It will cost, but it also frees us up to be the people that God sees we can be. Genesis 22 isn't just about Abraham proving something to God. It's about God forming something in Abraham. And maybe God is less interested in taking things from you and more interested in growing something in you. So wherever you are this week, you might be in a meeting, a lecture, on the school run, in the gym, on the train, at home alone. Just ask yourself, what would generosity look like in this place to the people that I'm going to meet right here? Your God still provides. And when we cultivate generosity, we become living reflections of the most generous gift the world has ever known. So who does God imagine you can become? And will you let him form you into that person? Will you give him back what it is that he's already given to you? May you open your hands today and let God empower you to become that person, so that together we can become the church he imagines we could be as well.